The impeachment of President Donald J. Trump. That and more on this episode of The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza.
I felt this thrill going up my leg.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
A president! Can you believe it?
This is somebody who knows what's right and what's wrong.
You know what podcasts are, by the way?
Talk shows for people who cannot make it in talk radio.
I just want to say to the men in this country, just shut up, do the right thing.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
Welcome back to The Uprising, a podcast of LibertyNation.com. I am your host, Scott D. Cosenza. Joining me today, as in most days, is the immediate past co-host of this program, Timothy Elting Donner. Tim, welcome from your remote location.
It's not a hidden bunker, but it might be. It probably ought to be.
No, it is a hidden bunker at this point. Oh, it could be anything. Okay. Theater of the mind, Tim. It could be anything. Could be anything. Archie the podcasting dog is somewhere about, and if the UPS man shows his face around, you will certainly hear him.
Likewise with our backup podcasting dog, Bentley, who also will alert when any delivery is imminent.
Tim, I want to talk about a story that we did talk about in last week's episode of The Uprising, but I kind of cut it out because I didn't like the way I had responded to the clip you brought to the table. And it's the Jeffrey Epstein story. By the way, hashtag Jeffrey Epstein didn't kill himself. I got to say that always. But it was a story about the Project Veritas people getting the ABC News person on tape basically saying, hey, we had the goods on Epstein and we were told to kill the story. And I wasn't kind of prepared for it to talk about it. And so that I didn't like the way I responded. So I want to talk about it now. And I think maybe the best way to start is to go ahead and play the clip.
I've had the story for 3 years. I've had this interview with Virginia Roberts. We would not put it on the air. First of all, I was told, who's Jeffrey Epstein? No one knows who that is. This is a stupid story. Then the palace found out that we had her whole allegations about Prince Andrew and threatened us a million different ways. And she had pictures. She had everything. She was in hiding for 12 years. We convinced her to come out. We convinced her to talk to us. It was unbelievable what we had. Clinton, we had everything. Every day I get more and more pissed because I'm just like, oh my God, what we had was unreal. Other women backing it up. Hey, yep. Brad Edwards, the attorney, 3 years ago saying, there will come a day when we will realize Jeffrey Epstein was the most prolific pedophile this country has ever known. I had it all 3 years ago.
Now, Tim, well, you're the one who you mind the clip. So I want you to tell me, what does that mean to you in terms of what they actually had? The reason why I was surprised, I wanted a minute to process it because I have some credibility questions surrounding Virginia Roberts, Virginia Jeffrey. I've been looking into her background quite a bit as it relates to Alan Dershowitz and the suit that he has going on with David Boyce, Clinton attorney. So that's sort of how I came to know Ms. Roberts. And I've also just it feels creepy to spend a lot of time on it. But words do matter in life. And Jeffrey Epstein is not a pedophile, has never been alleged to have been a pedophile. A pedophile is a person who is attracted to prepubescent girls. So 9 years old and below, basically. That's not Epstein. But in any case, so do you think that that it was an open and shut case based on ABC? Like, is that a conspiracy sort of on high killing of the story to you? Or how would you make of it?
Well, I don't know what the truth is here. It's true he's not a pedophile per se, though he's been depicted as such, sort of understandably, because he victimizes young women and uses them, or did use them, to
yes.
prostitute themselves. He pimped them out. I mean, we know all of that. Okay, he's not a pedophile. Good. Well, you know what? He's not Adolf Hitler either. That doesn't necessarily mean he was a guy
Yeah, he's not Albert Schweitzer either. I get that too. Right. Sure.
I mean, look, Scott, I think that this, what this Amy Robach revealed in the Project Veritas video, by the way, which is the James O'Keefe organization where they put in cameras with secret recordings to unmask these people on the left and the kind of things that they really are up to, which are different than what they're presenting to the public. But this was a recording of her speaking openly about the fact that the story was killed by ABC. So she'd have no reason to lie about that. So my question would, maybe she could exaggerate what she had, because journalists will tend to say, I have the next Woodward and Bernstein Watergate story. But there's no real reason for her to lie about the fact that they had an investigation. So you ask yourself, naturally, who benefits? The people that benefit are the people that did business with Jeffrey Epstein. And who's the most prominent of them? I'll ask you. Who's the most prominent person in the country who has been associated with Jeffrey Epstein?
William Jefferson Clinton.
That would be the one. So he benefits, his family benefits, the Democrats benefit. Everybody benefits from the Jeffrey Epstein story going away. I have no knowledge. I don't even have an opinion on whether he committed suicide or not. I know you do, although you haven't provided the specifics of what specifically was done. But nevertheless, of course, there's a thousand reasons to believe that he was murdered, but there's a few to believe that he would want to take his own life too.
Tim, I heard a new theory this week, just to throw into the mix, if it wasn't all confusing enough, is that he wanted to die, but didn't have the gumption to do it himself, so that he was murdered, but by his own dime, which is to say that maybe he paid one of the other either inmates or jail personnel to kill him.
You mean he hired an assassin to kill himself?
Yes.
But it'd be, the thing is,
much
Scott,
like the plot of a certain movie I know that you're fond of, Tim, when a certain Irwin Fletcher discovers a similar plot.
Fletch, I can't believe you said that, because we're getting to ready to watch that movie for about the 32nd time this evening, as a matter of fact, and it's one of my favorites.
I know that it is.
But Epstein, look. I mean, you always, in these cases, again, I go back to, you always look at who benefits from this. And it's pretty clear. And it's not just Clinton. There's a lot of other prominent people. You know, Alan Dershowitz's name has been thrown around in this.
Well, let me just stop you right there, because I actually did want to mention that. So Ms. Jeffrey, the woman who Amy Robach says gave them this treasure trove, she says that she was the sexual whatever device to give away to people. That's how Epstein in part used her, and that she was used that way by Alan Dershowitz. And Dershowitz, to say that he denies the charge is an understatement. I mean, he's, you know, they're involved in multiple lawsuits about this. So that's why I say, and by the way, she deserves to be heard on her allegations, but this is part of the notion of, believe all women. Like, no other woman has accused Alan Dershowitz of any impropriety. Sure. He's not a young man. He's had a long career, and he's been a powerful man for a very long time. What I mean by that is, if he wanted to use power over women in sexually inappropriate ways, it would stand to reason that you'd hear about it. Doesn't mean he didn't do it, but wow, it's good evidence, right? I mean,
but it's all fair game, and I'm wondering if, this, maybe it's somewhat unrelated, but I'm not so sure whether the Me Too movement is starting to really peter out, because you're not seeing this preoccupation with these stories of sexual harassment and sexual misconduct and sexual slavery, or whatever you want to call it. I wonder if the way this Epstein story is going, if this is indicative of how this Me Too movement, which we thought would define a generation, is really not headed that way at all.
Well,
do you make any association there,
Tim? It burned too many Democrats. That's the thing. They thought it was going to get They could, they could hold it back. Yeah.
I let you make that point. You're welcome, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, that's the reason why they thought they could control who the attack, you know, who the attackees were. And they couldn't.
Certainly they wouldn't attack anyone who had traditionally been pro-choice, right? Because that would trump any individual event that might have occurred. That's what we thought. But then the Harvey Weinstein thing just blew everything up because they didn't know what to do, because here's a guy who's an icon of the left and one of the most gruesome sexual predators that we've heard about.
So this, I think, is a great... I feel like it's creepy to keep returning to it, but I really do hate the death of language. I hear all these stories about Epstein, Tim, attacking women, young women. It's funny, they call them young girls, these late teens. And it's like, well, why, you know, the language is used to make us hate him. It's why I'm pushing back against the constant referrals to him as a pedophile, because pedophiles are seen as the lowest scum, worst people in the possible earth. So cast him with that brush. But you know what it
reminds me of, Scott? It reminds me of, you know, how Dead Men Tell No Tales. I remember Bill Casey, who was a CIA director for Ronald Reagan, prominent conservative, a guy who was involved in many aspects of politics and intelligence, and he held cabinet positions, by all accounts, a very powerful and impressive guy. But when he died and Iran-Contra came around, and then it kept carrying out further into the Bush administration, past the Reagan administration, it's funny how after Casey died, suddenly everything that went wrong in the Reagan administration and in Iran-Contra was the fault of Bill Casey, because he wasn't there to answer the charges.
Yes.
So it's amazing how many things can get pinned on a dead person.
Yeah. You know what? That argues, Tim, one of the things that argues for Jeffrey Epstein's murder, I think, is how much pressure it relieves from so many other powerful people and interests. It solves a lot of problems. A lot of questions don't need to be answered because of that death. So, the language I wanted to get to was just, they say Epstein attacked these women. And in that instance, attack means proposes that he pay them hundreds and hundreds of dollars for some sexual act. And then they leave. That's the attack. And then many of them would return many, many other times to continue getting paid. I mean, it's an act of prostitution. It's not appropriate to corrupt the morals of a minor, I think, for sure. But the idea that it's the same thing as like holding a knife to some lady's throat in an alley, is a bit rich. And meanwhile, Harvey Weinstein, he did attack women, right? He actually attacked a number of women. Okay. Well,
what are you going to do? What are you going to do?
Tim, we've focused on Cyrus Vance before, the New York City District Attorney, and his quest for the personal tax returns of Donald J. Trump. We know that of all the problems of the people of the city of New York, the potential criminality regarding the Stormy Daniels hush money payments is certainly worth millions of dollars of their efforts.
Why are you even discussing that? You just gave away 15 seconds. You'll never get back describing something that everybody knows.
Well, Tim, we have another person who you've shared much of your youth with making their debut, or not their debut, really coming to fore on the national stage. Duval Patrick, Tim, announces his bid for Democrat nominee for president of these United States. We know that you are also a former resident of the Robert Taylor Homes, where the two of you came up together on the streets of the South Side of Chicago. I'm sorry. I've got the bios.
Oh, boy.
I've got the bios screwed up.
Yeah. Sure. Honest mistake, Scott. Right.
You encountered Mr. Patrick at the Tony Milton School, where he was
a great word, by the way,
scholarship student, and you were to the manor born. Tell us about your, so Deval Patrick, first of all, just like, actually divorce yourself from the personal for a second. Let's just talk about it politically. Here's a guy who, is he a two-term governor of Massachusetts?
He was a guy who, his first venture into politics really was being named Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights in the Clinton administration. He then went on to serve as a vice president for Coca-Cola down in Atlanta, so he has private business experience. Then he came back to Massachusetts, where he had maintained a residence all along, I believe, ran for governor, won a second term, and then stepped out. And the thing that's notable about him more than anything else, Scott, is that he is the favorite of the Obama people. In other words, this is a guy that the Obamas wanted to run in 2016. It's too soon for a variety of reasons he couldn't. They wanted him to run in 2020. He said he thought about it and decided he wouldn't run. This was several months ago. But now, with this rush towards the judgment that none of these candidates that are in the race now can possibly beat Donald Trump, you've got first Michael Bloomberg and now Deval Patrick entering extraordinarily late, Scott. This is, you know, nobody has entered a primary race later ever than both Bloomberg, although he's not officially in, or Deval Patrick. So that shows you how desperate the Democrats are that this late in the game, just
it's a futile effort anyway. Hillary is moments away. Oh, yeah. Just
which would make all these other candidates irrelevant.
Out of their misery, okay?
Okay, I forgot. I'm sorry to go down the bunny trail of Bloomberg and you know, yeah. Of course it's Hillary, and of course, as she said, Scott, she will beat Trump again. She'll beat him again. She actually said that.
In a race that that he's running in, or just a race that she's the only one that she told people about.
Did you hear what she said this week? She said she's under great pressure from many people to run again.
Tim,
please, Hillary, run again, please. We want a sequel to 2016.
Here's what I want you to do: tell me something that she or Bill has said in the last 4 months that indicates she's not running. Okay, the evidence all points to they're laying the groundwork for her to come in. In fact, the Patrick addition to the race and the Bloomberg addition, I think, only add to her ability to say it's just too chaotic, it's too fractured. I just want to be a unify. I'm going to be a one-termer. You know, I'm going to set the ship right.
Right.
We're just going to get past this moment in history. We'll get a reset. I'm telling you, man, that's where we're headed. By the way, the best thing about Bloomberg is so he hasn't even declared for president.
He's entered one primary, which ironically is the Alabama primary, in which he would be lucky to get 1%.
But he had to put those papers in, or else he was going to forgo the ability to participate in that primary. That's why he filed. He hasn't declared. But you know what he did do already? Right. Issued a statement to the New York Times apologizing for his previous statements on women. They've all these quote books about things that he's said. And it's hilarious because he's a big money investment broker guy in the 80s, you know, not known for Tim.
So he comes right out of the gate apologizing.
Before he gets to the gate, he's got to shout his apologies down towards the gate area.
That's great. That is so good. It just so demonstrates where the Democrats are right now. They are so lost in the backside of the desert, and they have no roads, no pathway to get back to civilization. They're so far, and it's going to be worse after this impeachment thing. I'm quite convinced of it.
Well, let's let's take a minute, Tim, and really focus on Mr. Patrick, because we do really actually have a pretty cool thing, which is how many times does somebody know very well a person who has a legit cast their hat in the ring for president of the United States? And you do. And so let's mine your experience here. Tell us, how do you know Mr. Patrick and what your experience with him was like?
He's kind of a classic American success story, Scott. He grew up on the south side of Chicago, you know, where I live next door to him. Right. So he grew up on the south side of Chicago and in 1974 became the first student offered a scholarship through the A Better Chance program called ABC. And it was to get kids out of basically out of the ghetto and into private schools to give them an opportunity that they wouldn't ordinarily have. He was the first one out of the gate. And I befriended him very early in his time at Milton Academy, where we both went to school. And I got to know him very well. He was a very loyal person.
This is what grade are we talking about, Tim?
Ninth grade.
Okay.
Ninth through 12th. And we developed a friendship to the point where he flew into New York for my surprise 21st birthday party and slept on the floor in my parents' living room that night. And then later we reconnected when he came to Washington as the assistant attorney general for civil rights under Bill Clinton, came to our house, had him out, him and his wife and his kids. And I saw him and he had taken over. This was fascinating, Scott. You would have loved it. He had been assigned Hoover's office at the FBI. So wow. When I went in to see him in his office, he got to show me all the things that, you know, were associated with Hoover and everything.
Mm-hmm.
He said something else too, which I probably shouldn't share, but you know, regarding some of the more interesting elements of what we learned about Hoover. But in any case, you know, he's a guy that was always able to get along with people all across the spectrum because he was a black guy at a school that was, you know, 95% white. And he was able to really have really good relationships in both the black and the white communities and among teachers. He was seen as a campus leader. Let me put it this way, Scott. My parents got to know him very well, too. And none of us were surprised when he was elected governor. He had that look, had that successful look from the beginning. So he is something of a formidable person because, for one thing, unlike most everyone else in that Democratic primary, he's a guy with a pretty decent wit and sense of humor when he was first unveiling the fact that he was going to run for president.
Let me interrupt you. Would you call him a natural politician then in terms of his ability to grip and grin?
Very much so. Very much a natural politician and someone who can project. And part of the reason I think that Obama likes him is because he sort of projects somewhat like Obama. He's got some charm. He's got a personality that's somewhat attractive. He's considered, you know, in this field, he'll be considered a moderate. For example, he has said no. He does not support Medicare for all. He just wants to do Obamacare, improve it a little, and add a public option. Now, that's a smart position to take what we have now, improve it a little bit, instead of like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and the rest, take it and just throw it in the trash heap and start all over, which is turning the healthcare issue over to Republicans because they're now scaring people with their own plans, when in fact they had the big advantage on healthcare to begin with if they just with Obamacare, because the Republicans have no plan.
We're getting away from Mr.
Patrick. The Republicans have no plan. But here's the point. Deval Patrick is a guy who, if he'd been in this from the start, I'd say, you know, he would have at least a puncher's chance, given now that all these other candidates are going to have their backs up because his getting into the race is making the statement, hey, you're all losers. You can't win. I can. I don't know how well that's going to go over with his fellow Democrats.
Can you tell us, is he particularly studious or hardworking or neither or left or right? Or, you know, I want to get back into your personal experience because it is something you really have a vision in
I don't think I'm going to be telling tales out of school when I say that when we were at Milton Academy together, there was an incident at a fast food place where, let's just say, Deval Patrick was the victim of a really ugly racial epithet, which was
in Boston in the 1980s.
Yeah, yeah,
that's shocking. Oh, in the 70s.
Yeah. 70.
By the way, that, I think that's day he walks outside, I imagine.
But my point is that I think that had a profound effect on him in terms of believing that he should fight against this kind of thing, because he was not, he really was not a terribly political person the way I thought of it when he was in prep school. Now, maybe later at Harvard Law, he developed that, or maybe they came after him because he was such a, I mean, he's a perfect exemplar of what a, you know, a better chance kind of program could produce. I mean, he's the poster child for that. He's the first one in this school that, and now look where he is. He's running for president. So, you know, he is someone that you could look at his life story and say that's very impressive. But of course, I mean, most of these other presidential candidates in all the Democrats right up to Donald Trump, they've got stories to tell, too.
Like Native American Elizabeth Warren, for instance, and her struggle to be recognized. No comment? All right.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. What did you say?
I said like Native American Elizabeth Warren, for instance, and her struggles.
This is Scott. She fights Native American discrimination each and every day of her life that she gets up out of bed. I mean, that 0.0114% American Indian has been targeted by Trump-loving white supremacists, and we need to come to Senator Warren's defense.
She has banded together with all the other dozen millionaires to throw the billionaires to the people for their sacrifice so that she may continue on.
It's the new dynamic is actually very interesting in this race now, Scott, because Michael Bloomberg entering the race throws a monkey wrench into it by adding a totally different kind of candidate, a billionaire capitalist, which is exactly the kind of thing, billionaires and capitalism, that the whole Democratic field has been railing against since they entered the race. So
he's seen by that field as a old white guy with problems the way he's treated women in the past. Only Michael Bloomberg is pushing for the Michael Bloom and the people who make money off of his candidate, like, you know, the consultants, of course, that are going to be, you know, running his ad buys. They want him to run. But, you know, that's it. That's the big demand for his candidate services.
Well, we'll see. But I mean, I don't see where is the, I mean, if it's just, look, I don't care if the guy has two heads. If he can beat Trump, I'll vote for him. Okay, sure. But he keeps saying he's the only one, or he implies, or the people that are supporting him are implying that, look, he's the only one that can beat Trump. What is it that makes people think that Michael Bloomberg is someone who could out-Trump Trump? In other words, we'll take your bombastic billionaire and raise you a quieter billionaire.
Everybody in the savvy political world knows that middle America has been thirsting above all for a elderly Jew from Manhattan with radical progressive ideas. That's who they've been waiting for.
So let me ask you this question,
right?
And it begs to be asked.
Go ahead.
Because we asked this about Obama before he was elected. Is America ready to elect a black president? So let me ask you this one. Is America ready to elect a Jewish president?
I don't think so. But I also said I didn't think so with Obama. And I was obviously wrong about that. So perhaps I'm just projecting my own high level of anti-Semitism onto the rest of Americans.
Up to what point did you believe that Obama wasn't going to win because he was black?
Oh, I vastly overrated, and I think it's in response to my exposure to legacy media properties, Tim. I vastly overrated the racism of my fellow Americans up to and including during Election Day. I thought when they got in the booth, they wouldn't do it. And I was wrong. And I thought that race would have a big reason, you know, big. In fact, we know now, I think it's fair to say that, you know, America has come so far from a place where a black man could never get elected president because of the color of his skin to And I recognize this is going to be shocking to some people, a black man who got elected simply because of the color of his skin. You know, he was a candidate that allowed people to kind of shed off the yoke of racial bigotry by casting their vote for him. And so many did. For that, by the way, you know, for that purpose, he was a good president for the country, I think, generally, you know, for that one isolated thing.
Well, and I think he also, I will give Obama credit for one other thing, is that he did, and I think this is important. I don't know if it had any lasting effect, but he did affirm the black family and a fully parented black family, because it's an enormous problem in the country right now, is single motherhood and kids growing up with one parent. And the example that he set with himself and his wife and his kids, you know, they had the look of that together kind of perfect family. And I think just the example that was set by that, I thought was particularly useful for a country that needed it.
I think that both Tucker Carlson and Victor Davis Hanson would criticize what you just said in one regard, which is that the problem with Obama and Clinton too, in this regard, is they don't preach what they practice. And that's one of the biggest problems with the left. So these people who would never choose to have multiple children out of wedlock with multiple partners, for instance, they don't say there's anything wrong with it or indicate there's anything wrong with it to the youth. And basically, they kind of celebrate it in others, but they would never allow it in themselves. And that's sort of where a problem becomes. You know, that's what conservatives want, is for the prominent to drive the culture in a positive direction through their words, not just their deeds. So, all right. I want to talk about impeachment, but before we do, I want to give talk about the Supreme Court for a minute. Two issues. Number one is this Sandy Hook case, Tim. We talked about it briefly on the radio show. Liberty Nation Radio with Tim Donner. And these families, survivors, people who've had their loved ones murdered by Adam Lanza and Sandy Hook are suing the gun maker. You know, Tim, I think it's a case of something absolutely horrible has happened and they want somebody to pay for it. And Adam Lanza is dead. He ain't paying for it. So who do we turn our ire to? Surely it can't be, well, we just clap our hands and just go home and try to pick up our lives. That's not what has to happen. It's sort of like the, and I don't want to get into a Kennedy assassination conspiracy discussion, but it's sort of like that. People want,
I can do that if you want to, but
that's why I prefaced my comment.
As long as you want.
That's why I prefaced my comments. I did. No, but they say, you know, one of the reasons why so many people cling to the idea that there was a grand conspiracy, whether there was or not, is that the idea that such a pedestrian nothing could tear down greatness like this. And so I understand the appeal there that somebody or something should be to blame. But the gun maker, just like if Adam Lanza had used a Chevy truck to mow down a group of kids, Chevy shouldn't be implicated, and Bushmaster or Remington Arms shouldn't be implicated here. So what this case is, for people who don't know, Remington says, well, we shouldn't have to defend ourselves in court because we're immune from liability because of federal law that says gun makers who don't break the law when they make and sell guns can't be sued due to a criminal act by somebody who has possession of their wares. And the Connecticut Supreme Court says the marketing of how they sold their guns, including selling AR-15s to civilians at all, may have violated the marketing laws of Connecticut. And so they said to the Supreme Court, please help us. We don't want to have to bear the burden of this defense. Supreme Court says we're not going to weigh in. So that's where things stand. But the stakes, Tim, we talked about it on the radio show briefly. That's why it's such an important case, because if this law is allowed to go, is allowed to pass, or this ruling, I should say, it will be the end of commercial gun manufacturing in the United States to scale. I mean, occasionally you get a one-off manufacturer, but that's it.
Would you say that if the, let's say Hillary Clinton had won the election and she had nominated and had gone and they had confirmed a liberal justice, Merrick Garland or someone further to the left than him, and it was this matter came before the Supreme Court as to whether a gun manufacturer can be sued for the criminal use of their product, which was used as it was designed, but used for criminal purposes. If Hillary Clinton had won the election and that comes before the Supreme Court, what do they rule?
Well, yeah, this is, I think the point I get from what you just said is that Donald Trump's Supreme Court appointments or Hillary Clinton's would have been Supreme Court appointments make all the difference in the world when it comes to how these things are decided.
I do think so, because I think the fact that we could even ask the question, would a Supreme Court that's closely divided be willing to allow gun manufacturers to essentially be put out of business by lawsuits? And I think we can say clearly this Supreme Court won't do that. Maybe you think differently, but I don't think so. But would a Supreme Court, if you take Gorsuch and Kavanaugh off, or just forget Gorsuch because Kennedy probably would have stayed on the court. Just take Kavanaugh, swing vote, change it from Kavanaugh to Merrick Garland or someone more liberal than that. What happens?
Hold on. For those playing the Merrick Garland drinking game at home, that's one for them. Okay, let's go ahead.
I'll have to try that sometime. Of course, I don't drink, but I'd be willing to try for this one instance, Scott.
Anytime the Supreme Court's involved, somebody, you know, the first person to say Merrick Garland. Yeah. Well, I do agree. I don't think that the current Supreme Court would do that as well. But at the same time, for the right case with the right reasoning, it could go a different way. I can tell you that I do think that both Justices Gorsuch and Thomas, for instance, would actually make a ruling that would require some emergency action by Congress that people who are pro-liberty might think was an outrageous ruling, but that they might say, well, it's up to the Congress to do this legislating, not for us to do it. That we can actually roll that right in, Tim, to the second Supreme Court story. I mean, talk about, again, you know, matters who's appointed to that court. Donald Trump, we're told, and I read a couple stories on it right before we started recording. Jay Sekulow, as his attorney, said he's going to file two petitions with the United States Supreme Court. One petition to try to stop the Cyrus Vance advancement on his tax returns, and the second petition,
district attorney. Mm-hmm.
Exactly, and your former classmate as well. True. The second on the Democrat House members petition to see his tax returns from their subpoena. So to say that you know, it matters who's on that court.
Especially since we're in a position where we would actually ask the question, if the court were 5-4 the other way, would they allow gun manufacturers to be sued? And the fact that you didn't say, oh, no, I don't think they'd go that far, proves that there's a serious danger of that happening with the results of one or two successive presidential elections going to the Democrats.
I try now always when in my reporting to say which president nominated a certain judge when I report on a judge's ruling, because I think it's more important than ever to know. I think that's a sad state of affairs for the Republic. Well, hey, Segway King, that's right. Another sad state of affairs for the Republic is our current impeachment trial. What? Examination, Tim? Hearing? What's your preference?
Witch hunt.
Witch hunt. Inquiry,
witch hunt, scam, or inquiry? Okay. Any of the above are.
Let's say Wiccan inquiry. We'll go with that. Well, I thought that I didn't think it was a great day for Trump, but I didn't think it was a bad day for Trump. Generally, it was devoid of what I wanted to hear if I was a person who wanted to sink Trump, which was that there was some direct tie to him, to a demand, an inappropriate demand. And they partially established that, I think, with the phone call. But what I don't understand is this now just an attempt crime charge? And what I mean by that is,
right,
just to lay it out, you know, Tim, if I am delivering something to you, if it's my job to deliver you some goods, and I say to you, I'm only going to deliver you these goods if you give me $100 tip, and you never give me the $100 tip, and at some point I deliver you the goods, is my demand is it illegal? Did it breach the terms of the delivery? Well, if I've made the delivery, so Ukraine has been allocated this money and military help by the Congress. Trump can either deliver it or not at his discretion per the rules set up for delivering this kind of aid. Let's take, just so if it's not clear, I want to take the Democrats' argument at face value. He makes an inappropriate and let's even say, fine, illegal suggestion that aid will only be forthcoming if certain terms are met that aid him politically, to wit, opening an investigation against the Bidens and talking about same on media outlets. Neither of those conditions is met, and yet the aid still comes. So there's no crime. So there's an attempted crime. Is that what, are they now reduced simply to saying he attempted to commit a crime and wasn't successful in doing it?
Okay. So here's the analogy, and there's a perfect analogy to the last hoax, which was the Russia collusion thing, where they attempted, once they realized that there was no, not only did Trump not collude with Russia, but there was no collusion at all. There was no collusion. Therefore, Trump couldn't have participated in it. But when they went after obstruction, which, by the way, is what they're going to go after here when they establish that this is not an impeachable offense, they'll go after obstruction. But when they were going after obstruction, you remember that one of the central points they were making is that Trump ordered that the special counsel Robert Mueller be fired. He ordered his chief of staff to do it.
And remember when Robert Mueller got fired, Tim? Oh, right. No, that's right. He never did. Exactly. They wanted to hang him on the idea that he made an order that was, yes.
It's exactly the same thing, because the fact is, I can go you one better. I mean, not only was the aid delivered, and delivered on time, and not only were none of the, quote, demands that Trump made met, which could be more seen as negotiating points, playing hardball as a businessman, you say, I'll give you this, but you know what? I need this from you. It's a classic case of that. It's the way that Trump does business. Does it translate seamlessly to government? Certainly not. And that's what the problem is here with these career diplomats and swamp dwellers who know only one way to do things, which is that you do it the way that the foreign policy establishment tells you to do it. In fact, they think they're in charge of foreign policy. This is the problem here. They don't believe that Donald Trump can come in and establish what I think is the single catchphrase of the whole hearing, an irregular channel that Trump should not be permitted, even though he was elected president of the United States and is in charge of American foreign policy.
Tim, the State Department has been operating for hundreds of years and has strictures and all sorts of protocols that they have to go through. He can't just come in and upturn that apple cart just because he wants to.
That's basically exactly what they're saying. Now, I want you to play. Let me make sure I have the right clip, because I've tried to limit the number of clips to ones that would sort of exemplify the points that we're trying to make here. Why don't you, in terms of, there's two things here. The first thing is that what they're saying is an impeachable offense, never occurred, just like you said, because the aid was delivered. And by the way, That was lethal aid that the Obama administration refused to send them for 8 years. But now Trump sends them. If Trump is a Russian agent, which is exactly what the left is still saying, then why would he, departing from the Obama policy of no lethal aid to Ukraine, why would he then deliver lethal aid to Ukraine to protect themselves against the Russian Trump puppet masters? What sense does that make if he is in bed with Vladimir Putin?
Yeah, so for people who don't know, the Ukraine has requested weapons, that they be allowed to purchase weapons from us and that we give them weapons. And the Obama administration denied those requests, and the Trump administration granted those requests. So that's okay. What I wanted just to set the table, because I don't think that's widely known. By the way, you know what else is the best thing that you could do to probably help Putin as an American president? Massively restrict fossil fuel exploration in the United States of America. So Elizabeth Warren, when she wants to ban fracking, that's a Putin. That's like putting $1 billion a year into Putin's pocket. Let's ban fracking.
That's exactly what it's like. And I mean, the other point here is that everything that's been presented, and here's where we'll play the clip, which is Jim Jordan, the most effective, I think, along with Devin Nunes, member of the Republican side of the House Intelligence Committee, questioning Bill Taylor, who made all these statements about how he thought this was inappropriate and that was inappropriate, and he didn't follow protocol. The president had this irregular channel. And so then Jordan got to question Taylor's description of all the outrageous things that Trump had done.
Ambassador, you weren't on the call, were you? The president, you didn't listen on President Trump's call and President Zelensky's call?
I did not.
You've never talked with Chief of Staff Mulvaney?
I never did.
You never met the president?
That's correct.
You had three meetings again with Zelensky and it didn't come up.
And two of those they had never heard about, as far as I know.
And President
there was no reason for
and
it.
President
to come
Zelensky
up.
Never made an announcement. This is what I can't believe. And you're their star witness. You're their first witness.
Mr.
You're the
Jordan.
Guy. You're the guy based on this, based on, I mean, I've seen church prayer chains that are easier to understand than this.
I love that remark. In other words, you're saying, well, you heard from this guy who overheard a conversation with a guy who said that the president told him this. And Scott, this is such a tangled web of second, third, and fourth hand hearsay that you can't possibly cut through it. So first of all, it's hardly best evidence in a court of law, even though this isn't a court of law. And second of all, you know, when you cut through all of this, what's there? I mean, what's there
to remove? I want
to talk about
that court of law line for just a second, because I heard Speaker of the House Pelosi, I think it was today, talk about this notion that, well, they have to follow the law and they have to follow the Constitution. You know, we've talked to him a bunch of times since this first started about what is an impeachable offense. An impeachable offense is anything that a person who votes on the impeachment bill believes is impeachable or not. It's up to those individual voters to decide what's impeachable and what isn't. But this idea that we're following the law and the Constitution as if it's they don't have much of a choice. Like, discretion is quite limited here. I really hate that the legacy media has allowed them to get away with it, because what I think it does is they should have to sell America on the notion. Again, we're getting back to this. It's an attempted crime, right? So this attempt to solicit a damaging thing about the Bidens, if you grant that that's even what it was, okay, that is cause to remove the president of the to impeach the president of the United States. They should have to sell that it didn't actually work, right? That there was, we don't even know whether there was a real attempt, and that's worth impeachment. They should have to sell that, but they're not, because they're allowed to get away with this line, like, well, we're following the law and the Constitution. What?
Well, but the American people are smart enough to see through this. And the reason is not, Scott, because they're paying such close attention. It's because they've been seeing it nonstop since about 2 a.m. on November 9th, 2016, with Democrats talking about impeaching this president. You start talking about that early, that often, that frequently for over 3 years, people stop listening and they start wondering, if they haven't already, wait a minute, are they really saying there's a crime? Or are they just out to get this guy? I mean, and we're talking about, you know, the rank and file guy that's just going about his life and, you know, pays attention to the news here and there, but no more or less than the next guy. They're saying, wait a minute, now they're saying he should be impeached for this. I thought they just said he should be impeached for the Russia hoax. And then they said he should be impeached for Stormy Daniels, and he should be impeached for firing Comey, and he should be impeached for how many different things have they said he should be impeached for? So by the time we get to this one and you see a yawner of a hearing like there was on Wednesday, where there was nothing sexy about it. There's nothing to inspire the imagination of the American people, breaking into Watergate, covering it up. You have the, you know, you had the, you know, Gordon Liddy and all the guys that broke into the water. I mean, there was a story people could tell, and they were enraptured by the whole thing. The nation was tuning in. Everybody was focused on impeachment. And then in 98, when Clinton was impeached, there was not nearly that level of interest, but it was a lot more than there is now. You look at most newscasts last night on places other than CNN, and it's like the one story and maybe an analysis, and then they move on to the rest of it. If this was serious, this would be the only thing that was being covered by every single news outlet in the country. But if you look at the news today, it's remarkable how many other things have made the news when one of our two major political parties is talking about reversing the results of a presidential election.
From his bunker, in parts unknown, classmate to the Democrat political elite, Timothy Elting Downer, thank you for joining us on the podcast this week.
I'll never be appearing again. Thank you.
Thank you to Archie, the podcasting dog, and thank you for joining us. And thank you to LibertyNation.com for sponsoring this week's program. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Liberty Nation Gen Z is your portal for engaging articles without the spin, riveting videos that foster critical thinking, downloadable worksheets and quizzes for each age level. Liberty Nation Gen Z. A free thinking future starts here.